From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made when a tenant failed to pay their monthly rent to their Rochester landlord. This is a scenario that happens frequently, and the question becomes, what can and what should be done about it? For the past several years, this community has seen a heated debate about housing insecurity, tenant rights, the impact of new laws on property owners, and more. That's why a recent email caught our eye. A local landlord who wants to be known as an ethical landlord, someone who wants to do right by his tenants and wants to earn the reputation of doing things perhaps differently. But it goes beyond that. Benjamin Hart grew up in the 19th Ward in Rochester. He's not an outside investor. He's from here. He wants to live here. He started investing in property in 2006. And along the way, he has studied housing insecurity. Ben became a student entrepreneur and worked on formulating a new business model that he presented last night as part of the Simone Center for Innovation and Entrepreneurship at RIT. He's getting his MBA while exploring what it means to be an ethical landlord. He's interviewed dozens of people in Rochester about their housing situation. Now, some activists who work on housing justice have told us on this program that you cannot profit from housing ethically. That's not the view of all activists, but it certainly represents the view of some. They feel that commodifying housing is itself an unethical act. They want to change the system entirely. And I suspect Ben Hart has a different idea. He's here to take some questions about being a landlord who wants to be an advocate for housing justice and wants to share what he has learned with the public. Ben Hart is the owner of Hart Homes LLC. Welcome. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Stephen Brookstein is here as well. Steve is an adjunct professor of entrepreneurship at RIT and was Ben's innovation coach at RIT's Simone Center. Welcome, Steve. Thanks for being here.
It's a pleasure to be here and be here with Ben.
Ben, let me just start with a little bit of your own story. You grew up in the 19th Ward, yes?
Yes.
Went to RCSD.
All the way through until I got my GED.
Okay.
So a very unusual pathway, but yes, correct.
Okay. And when did you really start thinking about property acquisition, investing in property, becoming a landlord, et cetera?
Well, it was just flipping and all the shows, you know, that's what initially intrigued me. But 18 years later, I see it.
Shows about house flipping?
Yeah.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
You know, make money in 30 minutes and passive income, some of those myths. I fell for them a little bit. And over time, I realized, you know, it takes work. You have to add value. And because of my work, you know, I was building this business as an adjunct to my day job. And I always worked in health and human services, like at Hillside Children's Center. Right now, I'm a care manager at University of Rochester Medical Center. And I don't think I'm that unique. I think a lot of folks that own property, they want to be servant leaders, and they want to help the community. They see the rust belt challenges. They see the redlining, the lead paint, and they want to repair and provide housing stability. And as I talk to people, I heard horror stories, but I also heard my kindly landlord helped me buy a home. That we had a rent-to-own arrangement that was supposed to be 5 years. 17 years later, I closed, and they worked with me and didn't kick me out. So, like, there's definitely a predatory model. And in terms of the, you said the housing justice advocates, and I consider that a call to action and a market opportunity. I don't really think that politicians enforcing it is going to lead to lasting sustainable change. It's the old argument that only good landlords are going to follow the laws, and slumlords will continue to turn off the hot water, kick people out. So, you know, I think a market opportunity is more sustainable, right? I'm listening to those. Those are my potential customers. So I need to deliver value to them. I need to offer them pathways to ownership. I need to offer them predictable rent increases. I need to communicate rent increases well in advance. And everything that they're proposing on a legislative level, I think, could hamper innovation. But it's if private landlords opt into that, it's a win for everyone, and it's more sustainable.
All right, so we'll talk more in a moment about how Ben views that set of changes or set of ideas. Again, regulations or laws, not what Ben is after. He wants to see kind of a cultural change, or, you know, as you heard Ben just say. He doesn't believe that all landlords are slumlords, are all vultures or predators. He knows that's out there. It's a question of how do you change the culture so that becomes extremely rare and it's a much better experience for tenants, generally speaking. We're going to talk more about that in a moment. I want Ben and Steve to tell us a little bit about what happened last night and how you ended up working together here. So, Ben, can you take us through that?
Yeah, so at the Simone Center for Innovation and Entrepreneurship, there's a program called the Summer Accelerator, and it was a really life-changing program. It's really tied to innovation and entrepreneurship, and most of the student teams are very aspirational. They're trying to change the world ideas. I was the only existing revenue-producing business, but thankfully they let me in. It was an opportunity to work on the business instead of in the business. So build a brand, think about what differentiates me, and talk to people and listen to them. And I went to community festivals, neighborhood meetings, talked to homeowners because they're, you know, a stakeholder in this as well. Talked to politicians. I talked to Damon Meeks and William Burgess and Rachel Barnhart. You know, I really want to listen and understand because everyone's got a different idea of how to solve this. And I guess that's good because it's going to take a lot of ideas and no one has a monopoly on good ideas. I know what my value proposition is and what I'm trying to do. But there's other people that have different focuses, right? I was just talking to your colleague, Sarah, about the disability cliff, right? Aging parents. So they have a whole different lens to look at ethical housing. They're worried about people with developmental disabilities living at home with their parents, but then their parents age out. There's a certain cliff there. So what's the plan B when those parents go to a nursing home or pass away? So like a lot of people are thinking about this deeply, and I'm not the only ethical landlord by any means. And the more I talk to people, the more I hear really good stories. And like East House, right? They're a landlord and they're specifically, you know, focused on housing for folks that are trying to rebuild their lives after substance abuse. So I don't think it's an oxymoron. I talked to one woman, she said, it's only an oxymoron if you don't practice servant leadership. You know, Simon Sinek, he says, leaders eat last. People don't begrudge you, you know, your comfort or your profit if you deliver value, but they really don't like it when you say, this is passive income, look at me living on a beach and I don't have to do anything and I own 20 buildings, and that you don't talk about any of the customers that are paying those rents. Like that's when, you know, it all falls apart. And yeah, you don't deserve that. If you don't build it, if you don't add any value, if you're just predatory, you should find a new line of work.
So how did you hook up with Steve here?
So I'll chime in here. So I've been coaching in this student accelerator for 8 years, and I'm also an adjunct professor at RIT. And when I first heard of Hard Homes, I requested to be his coach because my take, and I'm not as steeped in the housing situation as Ben is, but from an entrepreneurial point of view, what intrigued me was we talk a lot about different business models, and I think he's really trying to bring to the market and a market solution, but in essence is a different business model. The idea of doing good and making money, typically we think of entrepreneurs as just making money, but this there's a large movement, if you will, about social entrepreneurship. And I think Hard Homes represents a great example of social entrepreneurship where, again, you can do good and make money. And I think he is thinking about the housing market, specifically here in Rochester, in a new way and applying a different business model to the typical tenant owner situation. So that's how we got hooked up.
Okay. And Hard Homes LLC currently has how many properties?
Six.
Six properties.
Mm-hmm.
What's the goal long term for Hard Homes?
Well, part of the model is keeping it small and sustainable. I think the problem is a lot of landlords, you know, go big and they want to buy 40 units and then kick back, or they, you know, they don't want to reinvest. They don't want to do the work. They want the passive income. And so scale becomes optimal. And that means borrowing other people's money, but then you're financing deeply. So my model is, you know, keep the portfolio small. My sense is that, you know, I think there's good programs out there, the ESL Home Buyer Dream Program, there's pathways to home ownership, but there's too much bootstrapping required. And there is a professional set of skills that I have, you know, to flip and remodel. I know all phases of construction. I know how to rally contractors. I know how to execute the project. So I'm taking houses that are generally uninhabitable. And I don't think, you know, the single mom or the CNA or the healthcare here, like they don't also have those skills. So they're not going to buy those houses. I'm going to buy them. But it's not, you know, you could flip them, but the margins are better in Pittsford, right? If you want to flip, you should flip in Pittsford. If you want to fix these houses, you do need to probably rent them for a time. And then my hope is I'll offer them to the tenants for sale, which which is one of the laws being proposed, right? Right of first refusal.
Yeah.
So instead of that being mandated by the state, I should offer it as my business model, and other people should follow in those footsteps and think through different models. So, you know, I'm going to keep my portfolio small, my holding period maybe 5 years, and then one of my commitments and part of my social mission is that when I sell, I'm going to sell to an owner-occupant. I've only sold two homes, but both of them were to owner-occupants, and I'm proud of that because I really want to be, I want to be my tenant's last landlord. I want them to move in and then buy a home either from me or from someone else, or I could represent them as a real estate agent. And also, if I sell and, you know, they move of their own accord, they buy somewhere else and they don't buy the house they're living in, when I sell and take my capital gain, I'm going to sell to an owner-occupant. That's my commitment.
Talking to Ben Hart from Hart Homes LLC. It's H-A-R-T if you want to learn more about Ben and what he's doing in Rochester. So let me press on a couple of points. First of all, I am curious to know if you think that the public is not well served by these flip 'em fast shows that you found kind of intoxicating a couple of decades ago.
Yeah, it was a big part of my presentation last night. You know, passive income is a myth, and people that are telling you that, they do two disservices. One is they rope people that are truly unprepared for the job of owning property and renting it out or flipping property. And then you get a lot of amateurs coming in, and then they'll tell you, you know, the reason they're telling you that is they're going to sell you their $1,500 3-day program, right? They're going to teach you everything you need to know in 3 days, low cost of $1,500, right? It's a scam. It's a true scam, and it's predatory. But then the other problem is then that's the public perception is like, oh, well, that's passive income, right? You know, maybe at scale if you own one of these downtown buildings, but if you're buying single family homes, onesies, twosies, it's a lot of work. And I enjoy the work. You know, I guess maybe I got hooked by that dream, but I ended up understanding it more deeply and falling in love with it and writing about it, thinking about it, studying it, and now it's who I am. It's my vocation.
So be careful with those programs and those shows. But yeah. This is the first lesson from Ben. But at the broad stroke of this is that you believe that there can be a movement toward a more just housing and a more ethical housing system without top-down laws and regulations coming in to change them. I would put this under the model of conscious capitalism, you know, movements like that.
Yeah.
And the critics, let me ask both of you about this. The critics of conscious capitalism tend to say that just the pure incentives of capitalism itself will inevitably lead to X number, some non-zero number of bad actors seeking to exploit, and that there has to be some sort of regulatory or legal balance to it, and that what you are describing is idealistic and probably unrealistic. What do you think?
You won't find disagreement from me that regulations are necessary. I absolutely believe that regulations are necessary. The FDA makes sure we don't, you know, eat poison food at the grocery store. I think the trick is every regulation has trade-off and may limit innovation. It may limit the ability of grown adults to contract with each other. And that's what I want to avoid. Like when you have a blanket solution, really, I think we have good laws on the books and that aren't going enforced. So my, you know, I'm not going to make any blanket statements about what's good or what's bad, because I think the conversation should be framed in terms of trade-offs. But in general, I think enforcement of fair housing, you know, when there's clearly deplorable conditions, that those need to be addressed. When tenants are breaking things on purpose and vandalizing, that needs to be addressed. And Darren Acemoglu, he wrote Why Nations Fail, and he talked about institutions and being able to redress your grievances, and that's how nations succeed. I think there's excesses of capitalism. I think there's excesses of socialism. It's not on the system. It's on ethical actors. And you know, I think I'm a religious and spiritual person, and I believe we answer to a higher law, and that's really the bottom line. And it doesn't matter what system you're put in. Good people will do good, and people, you know, you said, what did you say, the excesses of capitalism? I think it's the excesses of human nature. So regardless of the system you're in, you're going to see bad actors, unfortunately.
Okay, Steve?
Yeah, I'll just bring it down a level. I mean, I think Hart Homes, from a business point of view, is a proof of concept. I mean, he is proving in the market that you can be an ethical landlord. You can have aspirational goal to have tenants and ideally have them purchase a home. And his model allows for an extended period of time, unlike, so this almost through demonstration and proof of concept, what I would, and it's a bit idealistic, but you know, I think Ben is on the leading edge of perhaps changing some of these thoughts. So there'll always be bad actors in any and all businesses, but you know, that's an overused expression, but we shouldn't let, you know, perfect be the enemy of the good. I mean, he's doing something that's somewhat revolutionary and proving the concept out. And if others see that and can emulate that, then I go back to what I said earlier, what's wrong with doing good and making money? And that's fine. That's great.
All right. So let's talk. Let me make sure I understand, the listeners understand a little bit more about the model. And then I want to ask specific ideas related to the landscape of this current debate, everything from rent price increase caps to others. But let me just start with the model. It sounds like the first part of the model is don't own too much property. And I think a lot of people have bad experiences with out-of-town owners, corporations. You know, they're buying from afar. They're either flipping or just adding, as you've said, in volume without doing a whole lot of reinvestment or any new investment at all. So is that the first start, don't own too much?
For me, but let me be clear.
Okay.
You know, I'm not talking about the entire marketplace. So there's some empathy for mom and pop landlords, right? You say mom and pop landlords, they're a small business. They're just trying to make it. And people understand that and they empathize with it. But some mom and pop landlords, you know, they're amateurs. And they may not be mom and pop, you know, but it's like they're owning property. They don't understand fair housing. They're not licensed realtors like myself. They haven't studied it and they don't have proper screening. They don't know how to fix things. They're hiring contractors that aren't unreliable. And then, you know, it's just a vicious cycle of mess. And the same thing at scale. When you have economies of scale and you have someone at the helm of a big building that hires a good property manager, they might actually be doing better. They're less represented in eviction court. So when you own less property, you're more likely to go to eviction court, which is strange. But then again, the top two or three landlords in Rochester are constantly in eviction court. So like scale doesn't necessarily determine ethical or not ethical. And I think that kind of framework leads us to some, you know, class warfare, which I don't really find all that helpful. But it is something to think through. And I think when you're reaching across the country and you know, you don't know anything about Rochester, you don't know anything about the community, you don't care about the community, you're just trying to, you know, the people paying your rent are numbers on an Excel spreadsheet. Yes, I think that's extremely problematic.
And those scenarios definitely exist, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So describe your model then as best you can. What's the elevator pitch?
I had 6 minutes last night and I was able to keep it tight, but I like the longer form. I get nuanced.
He has an elevator pitch. You have one.
We've got 30 plus minutes here, but we'll try to keep this as tight as we can so then we can kind of explore different aspects. Go ahead.
Basically, just treat your neighbors like you would want to be treated and offer people pathways to home ownership. Be nice. It's my house, but it's their home. I think that's what people forget. Like, I own the house. And I've invested the capital to take, you know, from a dump to something that someone can be proud to live in. So that's what makes it my house. But I'm not going over there without giving you 24 hours at minimum. And that's enough if it's an emergency. I usually try to tell people like a week in advance. So be respectful of people's spaces. You know, half of what I'm doing is not that innovative. It's just following the laws, honestly. But the other half is talking about the laws and talking about and being intentional about it and saying, hey, you've been renting to me for a year or two. Are you interested in home ownership? If so, let's talk about it. Maybe I can help. And if I can represent them as an agent, great. It's a double win because I made a little more money. But if I can't, I still feel good about the way the relationship ended. You know, I've been in business 18 years. I've been in eviction court a few times. Sometimes contracts are not held up. But I've only locked one person out. And then I let them move back in as soon as they paid me. And I felt horrible about the whole situation, and I'd never want to repeat it. But, you know, overall, I've avoided eviction court, and, like, that's the model. Like, use it as a last resort. People are using it as a first resort, and they're doubling rents overnight, you know. So it's long-term home ownership, long-term leases, and predictable rent price.
And the only thing that I would add, even though Ben, it's Ben's business, but I see a service component. I mean, he provides a service. It's not only the provision of a home, but and having it rehabilitated, but as he mentions, he's very responsive, and that's a service. If you're renting a property, then anything that needs to be done, repairs or whatever, that's providing service. And any successful business has a successful service component. So that's what I find appealing, is that he has not only the investment posture, but a service mentality. And it is a business.
Mm-hmm. Ben, tenants' rights groups say that housing should be a human right. You've heard that.
Mm-hmm.
Do you agree?
I think I could agree, but who's providing that right? You know, if we say food is a human right, do we ask farmers to work for free? You know, or do we expect the government to pay those farmers to provide supplemental food for folks? And I think also there's two different issues, and I'm glad you mentioned it in your intro, right? There's homelessness. It's extremely visible. You could see people putting up tents. That's a whole issue. And I think nonprofits are very equipped to deal with that, and maybe government agencies. But housing insecurity, right? We don't want more people moving towards homelessness, right? If we think of housing insecurity as a spectrum, and there's homelessness on the one end and then sleeping, you know, having to move more often than we would like on another, I feel like that's where the market solution should be, because if not, then we're overburdening our nonprofits, we're overburdening our government agencies.
Would you agree then with the statement that you could get your head around the idea that housing is a human right, but we don't have a right to whatever house we want, and that the government has a right to fill in the gap when people cannot afford where they have been living? Is that where you are?
Generally. You know, I think it's complicated, but yeah, that's generally where I'm at.
So tell me a little bit about the only time you've had to lock someone out, and what led to that.
Just making payment arrangements and not keeping them over and over again, month after month after month, and telling me that they would meet me somewhere for the payment. And yeah, just but I followed all process of law. You know, I went to court. They had opportunities to pay then. And like I said, as soon as they paid, I let them back in. But creating that situation, you know, I wish we had other tools. And I wish they had other fallbacks, right? So, you know, we talk about maybe a well-funded housing court with arbitration, so that eviction isn't the only tool in the toolbox. And I would feel better if I knew that, hey, you're not meeting your contractual obligations. This isn't the place for you. I don't work for free. But I would feel better if I knew they had a place to go, right? So, you know, I'm totally not against, you know, more robust housing and more availability. But some of the things we're doing are complicating that, right? There's price ceilings and price floors. So good cause eviction could potentially create a price ceiling, but we also have price floors based on the tax rate and the kind of builds that we're approving. You know, there's a minimum square footage for builds. So we're not building tiny homes or single occupancy. We're, you know, and there's trade-offs, right? I'm not an expert on any of this. I'm only an expert on my business. And then everything else I try to talk about in terms of trade-offs. So,
okay. And one more question on this, and then we'll get to your phone calls. Mark, hang there. Listeners, if you want to call the program, it's 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255. 263-WXXI if you're calling from Rochester, 263-9994. You can email the program connections@WXXI.org. What is the largest annual rent increase that you think is reasonable, Ben?
Well, I think that's a double-edged sword. So
I'm not trying to do a gotcha here.
No, don't.
I'm literally trying to talk through what I think is one of the most thorny parts of this public debate.
Right. So my strategy is that if they're living there, it's a conversation. But year over year, if someone moves, that's when I really raise the rent. I kind of catch up to the market. But I understand, you know, keeping it in the range of cost of living, if improvements were done. But I think it's very clear when you are displacing someone just because you can make a couple of $100. And I think maybe, you know, that's a good strategy, but in the long run, you're hurting your reputation, you're hurting your community, and it's not right. But on the other hand, I just bought a house, right, in December. the tenant there was paying $900 a month for a 3-bedroom house, which is way below market. So in that case, I said, I'll keep your rent the same. I priced it into the buy because I knew I wasn't going to kick down the door and say, all right, pay me this much or
it's
you're
$1,200
now. Right. Right. So I said, you know, in 6 months, we'll keep it the same for 6 months. And then you decide what you want to do, whether you're willing to negotiate a new agreement with me or whether you move on or whatever. But there was, I think, a big part of it is just communicating, giving notice.
And what did that tenant say? Well, so you buy this house, they've been paying $900, and you said, look, I'm not gonna jack it up right away, but I'm gonna give you 6 months at this number, and then we'd have to come up with a new number, or it's fair if you want to find a new place. Did they protest?
No, she thought it was fair, and she bought a house. I mean, so she was well-positioned, and, you know, it was an unusual situation. It was her and her brother living there. Her brother moved out. You know, it can be, it's more complicated than a simple answer. But yeah, I do think you need to be sensitive. And I don't think putting a number on it is helpful, because if inflation is this much or your costs are that much. But usually before, when interest rates were really low, I would just keep the rent the same the entire lease period. Like, because it was my cost, inflation was low, my cost basis didn't really much change, and I thought that was appropriate. Now I have to think a little differently. It can really stymie my growth, and, you know, I've got to take care of my family and my kids and everything. But, yeah, it's very complicated, I guess.
So, again, part of what you are describing is a mindset as a property owner that says, I have to do right by the fact that there's inflation, or if I repair a property, if I improve a property, I may need to cover that cost. And I may build that into what I'm doing with rent. But I'm not going to try to be predatory. I'm not going to try to be unreasonable. I'm going to try to be around where the market is or better. And I'm going to try to communicate really well. That's what you're describing?
And it should be predictable. I think we're stuck in this month-to-month mindset. People like month-to-month as a landlord because it gives you all the power to change the rent overnight. And, you know, even when I offer longer-term leases, tenants, they don't want to be locked in. They don't want more than a year. But if you think about the commercial space, right? If you rent a storefront, if you sign a lease for 5 years, they're going to give you a better deal than if you sign for one.
Sure.
So some of that dynamic pricing is part of like the innovative contract model that you could do here in Rochester. Because we've got a tale of two tenants, right? We've got students. They don't want to be tied down. They might get a job. But they, you know, most of their family is homeowners and they have places to fall back on. And then you've got like these lifelong renters that really have little option. They're in poverty potentially, and their support system doesn't own homes either. So it's a totally different market and requires different considerations.
Okay, go ahead, Steve.
Yeah, I was just gonna say, but I think we might be missing the larger point, is that Ben is not in business to maximize his profits. He wants to make a fair return on his investments, and he has a family. He has to, you know, have income, but he is not pricing in such a way to maximize profitability, which is what capitalism is all about. So that's why he falls, I think, more in this realm of social entrepreneurship.
Yes. And what you just described is what leads to the only other question I have before I promise to get to the phones, because people have things to say. Mm-hmm. What you are describing, there's two sides of this. There's this idea that you want to be profitable, but not maximize profits and be predatory. You want to be fair. You want to help your community instead of potentially harming it.
It's the privilege of private ownership.
But right? You're also describing the fact that the leverage, the power, is especially with the landlords who have month to month, because they can, as in your own words, you said, they know they can change and hike up the rents anytime. Mm-hmm. And they like having that power. Mm-hmm. The reason that people who are in favor of law or regulation coming in favor those changes to the law is because they would say, Ben, you are the outlier. You may not be the only one, but you're not the average. And you just yourself said there are landlords who favor month to month because they can play with that rent and they can make more money and they can maximize. And what we need is a law that says, here's the highest number you can, here's the highest percentage you can go, month to month, year to year, whatever. And it's not perfect. You know, we're going to have to deal with inflation. We're going to have to deal with other factors, and maybe we can have exemptions, but we need that law because what you are describing is so idealistic, but it is not realistic. What do you think?
Well, Stockholm has rent control and they have 9.2 year waiting lists for an apartment. So, you know, there's consequences to price ceilings and price floors. In the current iteration of the law, it won't affect me. I own less than 10 units, and maybe that's an innovation, right, that would help. By keeping myself small, I can exempt myself from those laws. But I think there's a lot of power in private ownership, and I think I am maximizing profits. I'm just waiting for them. And like Wegmans, right, a lot of companies that have private ownership, they make ethical decisions, they invest in the community, and long-term, they grow better than these flash-in-the-pans, short-term, quarterly earnings companies. So I'm not sure. I just think when you police the whole market, you're going to have outliers that don't obey the law anyway. And then you're going to maybe stifle some other opportunities. With price ceilings and price floors, with price ceilings, it's supply, right? That's the issue that you run into. And that's what we're seeing. New York really is not building. New York is not providing housing. People are it's easier to put your money in the S&P 500. This is my vocation. I enjoy it, but I've done the math. I probably could have made more if I just truly passively invested in the stock market. So you have to make sure that it's fertile ground to invest in.
Sure, but what if the law and the policy included both a price percentage cap year to year and a much more fertile ground to build? You're right that this is not a state that is building a lot. It's not a city that's building a lot. The general rule of thumb in this country, not to get overly political, is in blue states, it's harder to build. In red states, it's a little easier. Austin, Texas is a great example of a place that's building like crazy. So what would happen if that changed? If we said, all right, we're going to do the price cap, but you're also going to see a lot of new builds here. And that'll help deal with the supply issue. What do you think?
Well, new builds have trade-offs too, right? Urban sprawl is a big issue. So, like, I guess you're asking me questions a little too far out of my expertise.
Okay, that's fair.
But I'll say that I think I just think that you have to be very careful with how much you want to level the playing field, and you want protections. And if one person is not holding up their part of the contractual bargain, they need to be held to account. That's why I believe that a better solution is enforcing what's on the books, robust housing court, dedicated judges. You know, they shouldn't be going to traffic court, then to, criminal court, then to housing court. We need dedicated, trained judges that look at these cases and that take the slumlords and break them across the coals, and same with tenants that are vandalizing. I think that's your solution. When you try to do blanket market policies, you really end up running the risk of unintended consequences, inability to contract for short-term rentals, right? Some people like short-term rentals, mid-term rentals, right? These are being removed from the marketplace artificially, even though there's a demand for it and people want them. So that's the trade-off you're facing. And I'm not fully decided on it. All I know is that if people are parading in the streets and they want this, then I, as a landlord and other landlords, should say, if we don't want politicians mandating it, provide it. Give people five-year leases. Tell them up front, hey, I will provide a five-year lease. You can predict 5% or less every year, and make it a part of your promotion. Like, that's how you solve this in a sustainable way without the unintended consequences. And that's why I'm trying to be a thought leader. And so I'm not just talking to, I'm talking to other landlords too. Like, get your stuff together, because if not, someone's going to do it for us.
And you're advocating a market-based...
Yeah.
Industry.
Yeah. Yeah. It works better.
But that last point is important. Ben's saying if we don't behave ethically as a group of landlords, we will see laws and regulations come.
Yeah. And we've got trade associations for realtors, for lawyers, for doctors, right? This is important. And landlords have avoided that to some extent. And then we've got this whole wholesaling industry that's really problematic and predatory too. So you can go there if you want.
All right. To the phones we go. We're talking to Ben Hart, owner of Hart Homes LLC. Stephen Brookstein is here, an adjunct professor of entrepreneurship at RIT, and Ben's innovation coach at RIT's Simone Center for Innovation and Entrepreneurship. And Ben is talking about not only his time, about 18 years now, of owning property and being a landlord in Rochester, but the model that he sees, in his view, is a smart one. It's a way for landlords to go forward, to do right by their tenants, to do right by a community, and still be profitable, if not maximizing profits. Let's get some feedback here. Mark Johns first, county legislator, former state legislator. Hello, Mark. Go ahead.
Hey, good afternoon, gentlemen. Listen, I just want to point out why home ownership is a good idea, and then actually give you a solution, or at least one. Homeowners care more about their community. They care more about their neighborhoods. If you have a lot of people in an area that own their home, they're going to keep their yards clean. They're going to keep their property up because it's going to keep up the value of the neighborhood, the community. They're going to be more involved with the schools in the area. They're going to become better citizens, really, because they have a stake in the game. If you're a renter, you don't really have as big a stake in the game. So let's turn renters into homeowners. It's a great idea. And second is, we always talk about, where's the money going to come from? There's a lot of working poor, and you hear all these politicians, oh, I care about the working poor, I care about women with kids. Well, you know what? You and your audience don't believe that. I don't. But the fact is that we could do something in New York State. And what we could do is start by getting rid of two-thirds of the state legislature. Let's go to a unicameral legislature. Do you guys realize that I think when I left the state, it was maybe $250 million a year to run that state legislature? If we just had 75 total legislators, call them all senators, we'd save at least $100 million a year. And we could give working class people, the working poor, 20% down plus closing costs, and they could buy some of these houses. It's not going to be real expensive areas, but they could have 20, 30 grand down. Because they put at least 20% down, they're not going to pay PMI. So on a 30-year mortgage, they're going to get the optimum mortgage. They're going to have a stake in the game, and we can use that money instead of paying a bunch of career politicians multi-million-dollar pensions and everything else. Let's have them turn their words into actions. There's a way you can save money with never raising taxes, getting rid of a bunch of rich career politicians and doing something for the working poor instead of pretending like you care about them. Let's actually do something.
Mark, thank you. As always, we appreciate it. That's Mark Johns. Gentlemen, what do you think, Ben?
Well, we got a little far afield, but I agree that homeownership is extremely important. It's very valuable. I would like to see more of it, especially in the city of Rochester. And that's really a problem I am trying to solve. It may seem unusual for a landlord to say that because I make money off of rent. But like I said, my commitment is to sell to an owner-occupant. I invest exclusively in the city. We've got about 70% rental stock in the city and 30% home ownership. And in every other suburb, it's almost the exact flip. So I would like to see the city have 70% home ownership, 30% rent. What I feel like my role is to manage the project. Take these homes that have been, they were redlined, right? They have lead hazards. They have asbestos hazards. Like, someone skillful. And don't get me wrong, I'm also getting a ton of community support. And I can't take credit for this idea without Simone Center and their support. But previous to that, you know, I met Steve at Hobart. We took a course on social. I took a course with his colleague, Craig Talmadge, on social entrepreneurship. Pathstone offers their landlord class. I encourage anyone interested in this business in any capacity to take that course. They taught me about ethics. They told me to do things like don't charge security deposits, right? I never charge security, don't charge application fees. I do charge security deposits, but don't charge application fees. And he humanized the problem for me. He's like, if you take that and you don't accept them and they have to apply to 8 places all over town, right, that's a cost. So before it was law, and I think good companies, they exceed regulations and they go beyond them because it's good business. It's, you know, it's good karma. It's all of that. So, but in terms of tenants not having stakes in community groups, it is a problem. We went to some community meetings, and they were dominated by homeowners. And I said, "Do you outreach to tenants?" And they said, "Well, we've tried. I can't say for sure if it's an outreach problem or if it's the tenants don't feel any permanence. But I would hope that, you know, if you're renting a hard home and you know you can stay for 5 years at a predictable rent increase, then you would go to community meetings, you would vote, you would care about your community. But that's the problem that Matthew Desmond talked about in his book, Evicted, is like, if you don't have rootedness, you can't work on your education, you can't work on your career, you don't have an address, you know, your mail gets lost, right? All these, and I, as a care manager, I'm going into these homes, I see housing as the base of the pyramid. If you don't have that, you can't have a neighborhood. Kids are changing schools a ton. They're changing addresses. We've got 2,000 homeless kids. State Assembly Mayor Harry Bronson shared that quote, 2,000 homeless kids at any given time
living
in shelters in RCSD schools. Yeah. That's like 10%. So like landlords, you have a role in stabilizing this. You don't have to kick that family out just because you can get an extra $200. You know, just maybe charge them $25 more, right? You know, cover your costs. But, you know, I think greed, and don't get me wrong, greed can happen in socialism, right? There's greed and corruption in everything. So it's not about the model. It's about being ethical and human to human.
You're smiling, Steve.
Well, I was just going to say at the 50,000 foot level, which goes way beyond the scope of our conversation this afternoon, is the larger issue of income inequality. I mean, look at what has happened in our country over the last 20, 30 years, and it's getting worse. And I think that feeds into the whole notion of housing and housing insecurity. But, you know, as a society, until we fundamentally confront the larger issue of income inequality, which has all kinds of implications to tax policy, et cetera. But to me, that's the overarching. This becomes a subset of that. But as I said, that goes beyond the conversation this afternoon.
All right, let's go back to your phone calls. Gary in Bloomfield. Hi, Gary, go ahead.
Hey, thank you. I was kind of surprised you got to me so fast. My concern or my questions have to do with I know you listened to your guest there, and he was talking about there's different kinds of tenants, and I totally agree. But there's also different kinds of landlords, and I think one of the questions or concerns I always have is in a capitalistic market, speculation is actually not a good thing because it tends to create artificial markets. And so when you have corporate investors buying up lots of land and then taking things off the market, that forces the price of the rent up artificially. I think there should be a different set of laws for local landlords who, like your guest, keeps us business small so that he can be connected to the, and he's also, smaller people get more connected or more responsible to their community. Whereas the corporation who, you know, lives in a different city or country or state, they have absolutely no, they're just there for the money. And I think that there should be a different set of laws. An example being, you know, if you buy a property and you take it off the market, you should have a certain limit in the time that you have to start that work in order to get that unit back on the market as soon as possible. And there should be consequences for that. When you, when we talk about regulations, I mean, it's become a bad word, but regulation is really, whenever you hear the word regulation, it really means protection from some, you know, from some kind of abuse. So I want to address that kind of general issue.
Gary, thank you for the phone call. What do you think, Ben?
Gary said a lot of really good stuff in there. And yeah, regulation does protect people, but it has costs, right? It can stymie innovation. So it's a trade-off situation. And I'm not fully for or against regulations. I just think we need to think about them in terms of trade-offs. In terms of supporting local landlords and local investment, I think that's important. And he's right. Speculation creates bubbles, you know, from tulips, right? You know, the tulip bubble, like we've seen it over and over again, and it is the result of greed, and it's the result of not adding value. You know, when you make money the old-fashioned way by earning it, you really don't have to worry as much about speculative bubbles because you have added enough value along the way and you don't owe everybody all over town because you roped your grandma into buying this house and you'd never, you know, hammered a nail or slung a paintbrush, you know. So me, I feel very confident that I do add value and, you know, I'm sticking my neck out there. I'm being more public about this for 17 years, right? This is my 18th year in business. I just kind of patted myself on the back and said, I'm not one of them. I'm a good one. I care. You know, I'm gonna be a mensch, right? I'm going to be a good guy. But now I realize the need. You know, when Damon Meeks was on your show and you talked to him about getting arrested that eviction, I was angry because I was like, oh, this isn't the whole story. But then, and even when I read Matthew Desmond's book, right, it challenged me. But both of those things and the entire zeitgeist around the eviction moratorium, it forced me to grow and level up and, like, be who I want to be. And so I'm pretty proud of the direction I'm taking, and I'm not, you know, quietly patting myself on the back saying, you know, I'm a good landlord, I'm one of the good ones. But I'm going after the bad ones, and I'm calling them to account, and I'm encouraging other ones that really care to show it, put their money where their mouth is. And, you know, I appreciate you having me on.
So, Ben, if people share your vision and want to support you, is there a way they can do that?
Yeah. So the Rochester Area Community Foundation gave me a few grants for repairs. There's a lot of, you know, right, home leasing is getting a ton of money to do their fix over right down the street on State Street. But I think there's a lot of micro grants that are happening, and I've benefited from them to remove and abate lead paint. So there's a lot of ways like that. So I think those should be encouraged. As for me, I'm open to investment, people that want to make a social impact. I'm trying to get Kiva platform going here in Rochester, which supports small businesses. But it's tricky because even the tax code and the business code, like, I can't get Small Business Association support because it is considered a passive investment. So, like, even the tax code has kind of got that language embedded in it, which makes it really tricky to get kind of some of the other entrepreneurial ecosystem supports. But I'm still finding it. I'm going to be competing in Rock the Pitch on August 22nd. It'll be a retooling of what I presented last night. And really, there's a lot of ways to help. Time, treasure, talent. If you're willing to take a lower return on your money and give me $25 on the Kiva platform, I'll use it for good purpose. You know, there's divesting in oil and natural gas. So invest in the landlords that you think are doing good, and don't invest in the ones that just promise you a big return.
What's the website, by the way, for Hart Homes?
www.harthomesroc.com.
HartHomesRock.com. Chad in Cayuga County is next on the phone. Hey, Chad, go ahead.
Thanks very much. I've been a small-time landlord for the last 50 years. And one of the things that I've found with younger tenants when they arrive is that they don't know how to manage their personal finances. And one of the things that I had to do last fall after a new tenant got 6 months behind on her rent was we had to have a sit down and go through I taught her the envelope method of financial management, you know, the same thing that my dad taught me when I was 10 years old, 70 years ago. And it's a great lack that I hope that people can offer to tenants some knowledge about managing their own finances for purposes of whether it's making the rent or making their eventually their house payments.
Thank you, Craig.
Well, Ben, what do you think here?
Well, Matthew Desmond talked about this as well in his book, and he said, you know, first of all, I don't speculate. As long as I'm getting paid, I don't care what they spend the rest of their money on. It's their business. I've heard a lot of people use dehumanizing language and say, well, they got money for Nikes, you know, they live better than me. I don't care. Live however you want to live, as long as you agree to what, you know, follow up on your agreements. But, you know, there's two sides to it, right? There's personal accountability, there's skillfulness. These things should be taught in school. But I think also when you don't have housing permanence and you don't have housing stability, Matthew Desmond says you wear gold chains because at least you can store that wealth on your person and you can keep it. So, like, there's certain mindset differences that, you know, we have to be sensitive to, we have to understand. And I think when you don't have a home, the way you approach money is so much different. And even if you have a home for now, but you're not sure that you can live there in the next year. So that's very complicated, but, you know, it sounds like he did a good deed there by, you know, offering his help and support. I don't fault him for that, but he's bringing up very interesting things that we could talk about all day.
Real briefly here, let me just try to squeeze in one more. Jane says, Evan, there needs to be protections for tenants regarding rent increases by landlords. My rent went up $235 a month this year, which is a 21% increase. It went up by 19% per month last year. This is greed and unsustainable. There have been no cost of living increases at work. There have been no improvements or upgrades in the apartments or the complex itself, and I had no recourse. And Jane went on to say, this isn't Webster. Any regulations need to be countywide, not just in the city. I should not have to get a roommate in my 40s just because I'm single due to the greed of landlords. That's from Jane. What do you think?
I'm sorry for your situation, Jane. I've talked to a lot of people experiencing what you're experiencing. I guess I would say in the short term, I don't have a lot of answers. But in the long term, I hope that you can find a landlord that cares enough to negotiate, you know, predictable rent increases with you. And that can be part of the conversation up front. You can go to your next place and you can say, hey, I want to live here for 5 to 10 years. What can you, you know, are you interested in that? Are you serious about, you know, building a relationship? And it'll be about financial literacy. It'll be about willingness of landlords to respond it. And I agree, there's serious power differentials, but that's a tale as old as time. Whoever owns the land has the power. And I'm glad that there's protections. Glad there's fair housing. So Jane, just keep it up. And I'm sorry for your situation.
Ben, you're in an interesting position because there will be landlords who agree and disagree with you vehemently. There will be tenants' rights activists who agree and disagree with you vehemently. Will you come back soon and sit with them together and have a constructive conversation?
Sure. It's all about compromise. You got to talk to everybody. We were on WYSL, very right-leaning show, and today it's a little more left, so willing to talk to anybody.
We like to think that we're the home for everybody to have productive conversations, and Ben Hart is the owner of Hart Homes LLC. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Our thanks to Stephen Brookstein, professor of entrepreneurship at RIT and Ben's innovation coach at the Simone Center. Thank you for being here.
My joy.
More connections coming up in just a moment.